All right, options traders, listen up. I want to tell you a bit about public.com, but first, have you ever actually thought about all the fees you're paying to trade options? Aside from the regulatory fees, there are commissions, and most platforms charge per contract fees too. That's what makes today's sponsor, public.com, so interesting. Public doesn't charge commissions or per contract fees, and in an industry first, they offer a rebate of up to 18 cents per option contract traded. Check it out. If you trade 1,000 options contracts on Public, you'll get up to $180 in rebates. If you trade 10,000 contracts, you could earn almost $2,000. More importantly, the rebate means you can maximize your profits and minimize your losses. To recap, no commissions, no per contract fees, and up to 18 cents on every contract traded. See why NerdWallet recently awarded Public 5 stars for options trading and start earning up to 18 cents per contract traded only at public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures are in the podcast description. U.S. members only.
Welcome to Chit Chat Stocks. On this show, hosts Ryan Henderson and Brett Schaefer analyze businesses and riff on the world of investing. As a quick reminder, Chit Chat Stocks is a CCM Media Group podcast. Anything discussed on Chit Chat Stocks by Ryan, Brett, or any other podcast guest is not formal advice or recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Chit Chat Stocks. Today we are joined by first-time guest, Peter Slagers. You may know him as Compounding Quality on Twitter, now X, or you may know him from his Substack, Compounding Quality, and he just published his first book, if I'm not mistaken, unless there was another one I'm unaware of, The Art of Quality Investing. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, but we're also going to talk about his framework in general. I guess to kick things off, welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you very much, Ryan. I would say what you guys are doing is amazing. So it's an honor to be here, and hopefully we can have a very nice conversation over the next hour and learn one or two new things, right?
Yeah, appreciate for sure. It. Okay, so I want to dig right into your framework. So people that know you know that you like quality growth, growing companies. Can you give us a sense of your actual criteria that you look for? What do you use to identify high quality stocks?
Sure. So probably the name Compounding Quality already tells you a lot, right? So compounding, magic of compounding, compound interest, and then quality. So quality investing. So the essence here is that I try to let the magic of compounding do its work via investing in quality companies. And that's also why The Art of Quality Investing was written in the first place, because I worked together with Luke on this one, on the book. Luke and I felt like a lot has been written about value investing, growth investing, and so on. Everyone has probably read the books of Benjamin Graham, the books of Phil Fisher about growth investing, and so on. But not that much has been written about quality investing. So basically, the book tries to give an entire framework about how can you find these kind of companies. And in the book, we make a separation between quantitative methods or quantitative criteria and qualitative criteria. So qualitative criteria, think about first and foremost for a quality investor. Well, does the company have a moat or competitive advantage? Do they have pricing power? Well, are they well diversified geographically, client, and so on? And then the next part is to dive into the quantitative criteria. So obviously the return on invested capital or capital allocation is very important for quality investors. Also the growth, historical growth, as well as the outlook, the balance sheet, the free cash flow conversion, so free cash flow and earnings, and so on. So basically, there is a criteria, a framework we use to find these kind of companies. And based on that, over time, I guess you are building your watch list, building your investable universe. And based on that investable universe, obviously, you're trying to create your portfolio and hopefully to outperform the market, right? Because that's probably the goal of every investor, to do better than the index. Because if you don't succeed in that, well, you would probably be way better off to just buy the index sit back and relax and go do completely other things like golfing or fishing or watching football or whatever you want.
How do you find a lot of your ideas? Is it something where do you read a lot of blogs? I know you have specific metrics that you like because you and I have talked before. Do you use screeners as a part of your idea generation process?
Yeah, I think probably the most important thing to do is to just read and read a lot. So probably spending around five hours a day reading, and then not sure when our conversation will be published, but right now it's the end of April, right? And I'm keeping a list since this year and read 33 books so far this year. So besides the 10Ks and so on. And I guess the more experienced you are, the more ideas come to you. And it was Monis Pabrai who said, for example, well, I'm a shameless copycat. And I feel the same way in the sense that you can learn so much from looking into portfolio of Warren Buffett, obviously, but compounding quality, talking about quality stocks, to look at the portfolio of Francois Rochon, Chuck Aker, Terry Smith, and so on. And just get your ideas there, read their shareholder letters, which are also really insightful. And by doing that over time, the more you do that, you probably get a good grasp about what kind of characteristics certain companies should have. And this allows you to recognize one once you stumble across one, right? So just looking at the portfolio of super investors, quote unquote super investors, can be insightful. And then obviously you need also using stock screeners to try and find great companies already. Because worldwide, there are probably something like 60,000 listed stocks. And I think we can all agree that you can't analyze everything. So the philosophy I have a bit here, and you can use a stock screener like FinChat, is that you try to use quality criteria. And like I like to call it, you try to remove the weeds or the bad companies and only be left with beautiful companies. And obviously, you can base your investment decisions purely based on a stock screener. But when a list of, let's say, 250 companies remain, well, it can be very good to start doing your own research. And looking into 250 companies is already way easier than looking at 60,000 companies, right?
How important is return on invested capital, otherwise known as ROIC, in identifying a quality stock? And what one thing I always get hung up on is the actual definition of return on invested capital, because as we've seen from, you know, the famous papers from Michael Malbosan, apologies, mm-hmm. Michael, I know you're listening, but I always mispronounce your name, but defining, you know, I mean, net income or free cash flow, that's there. That's easy to define. Mm-hmm. But how do you define the invested capital, and how important is ROIC for you?
Yeah, I would say you can never make an investment decision based on solely one criteria. But I would say that return on invested capital together with the moat is probably, for me at least, one of the most important things. So for me personally, I always want the return on invested capital larger than 15%. And some of you may know the quote from Charlie Munger, who basically said, and I'm paraphrasing here, well, when you have a business with a return on invested capital of 6% and you keep it for 20 years, well, your return will be equal to roughly 6%, even if you buy it at a huge discount. And conversely, when you have a business with a return on invested capital of 18%, well, if you keep that business for 20 years, well, you will end up with one hell of a result, even if you buy it at an overvaluation. So also Charlie thought that the return on invested capital is really important. An important side note to make here is that it's only as true when the company has plenty of reinvestment opportunities, right? So when it can reinvest everything back in the business. Maybe we can delve deeper into that if you want to. But just to make the point, well, return on invested capital is really important. How do I calculate the traditional variant? You just take indeed the NOPAT, net operating profit after tax, divide by the invested capital, right? And then indeed you can discuss which things you want to include in invested capital. That's also, for example, why some people prefer to look at return on capital employed, for example, instead of return on invested capital. But what I think is really important is to just play around with the numbers a bit. In the sense that in the book, for example, and maybe important to highlight here, Luc Caruso is the author of the book. I worked together with him, and credits to those who deserve. Well, he did 99% of the work, and I truly believe in the book as well. But Luc did an amazing job there. But in the book, we talk about two variants of return on invested capital. The traditional variant, and then you have the operational return on invested capital. Now, what is the difference? The traditional variant is NOPAT divided by invested capital. Why is this one interesting? It's just to look at how efficiently is management allocating capital. And in this case, in invested capital, we just include all the traditional variants. But then with the operational return on invested capital, we exclude goodwill and cash out of the invested capital. Sometimes it can make sense. When can it make sense regarding goodwill? Well, it can make sense when, well, I'm going to give you an example. Medpace, for example, they have 50% goodwill on their balance sheet. But what's the reason for this? It's because they did a private equity deal a few years ago, around 2014, if I recall it correctly. And based on the private equity deal, it was one-off deal, and they got 50% of their balance sheet was goodwill from that point in time. But Medpace never does any acquisitions. And when there was a lot of goodwill on the balance sheet, just because of one big exceptional transaction, in that case, it makes sense to me to exclude goodwill. When a company is a serial acquirer or something like that, or it regularly acquires other businesses, well, I would definitely include it. But yeah, due to exceptional terms, excluding goodwill can be interesting. Also cash, when a business has a lot of cash in the business, it can make sense to exclude it as well. For example, when the business has a net cash position of 5% every single year, well, in that case, the business or the company doesn't need the net cash position for its operations, for daily operations. And in that case, it can make sense to exclude it. But to get back to the points for operational return on invested capital, why is it important? It's NOPAT, or net operating profit after tax, divided by invested capital minus goodwill and cash. And this is a really interesting one to look at how much money or how much of its free cash flow or NOPAT a company needs to grow at certain rates. And it underlines also once again why return on invested capital is so important. So for example, when you have a business that wants to grow by 10% in 2024, and they have a return on invested capital or an operational return on invested capital of 20%, to know the reinvestment rate, you divide the required growth rate by the return on invested capital, which is 10%, the growth rate you want in 2024, divided by the operational return on invested capital of 20%, is 50%. So this means that the business needs 50% to grow by 10% per year, and 50% or the other 50% they can use for share buybacks, dividends, and so on. But when you have a business with an operational return on invested capital of 50%, for example, well, same exercise, growth rate divided by operational return on invested capital, 10% divided by 50% equals 20%, and then can use the remaining 80% for share buybacks, dividends, and so on. And this is also the reason that it was Chuck Aker who said, well, when you have a quality business that can reinvest everything back in itself, everything in organic growth, that's a compounding machine, that's the golden goose for you as an investor. But those companies, those quality businesses, are often so good, they are capital light, very profitable, they require very little capital to grow at certain rates because their return on invested capital is so high. And this means that they just don't know what to do with their cash after a while. Take Apple, for example, take MasterCard, which are beautiful businesses. And they are heavily buying back shares nowadays over the past few years. And it's just because they don't have enough organic reinvestment opportunities to reinvest the cash in itself, because that would be the best way to create shareholder value. And that's exactly why the golden goose is really quality with plenty of reinvestment opportunities probably.
I really like that. Okay, follow-up question for you. Are there any industries that you would not invest in? Because I've seen some of your like quality lists, and it seems like you have companies from all over the spectrum in terms of industry. Is there anything that you would not touch?
Yeah. I always say, general rule, well, investing is all about saying no as soon as possible, because you have so many ideas that I just, obviously the criteria you use are very strict. And also means that only 1 or 2% of the all listed stocks fit your criteria. And obviously within the 98%, there will be plenty of good companies, but there's no problem, or at least for me, you have no problem with excluding them. Now, which kind of companies are you excluding? Well, always investing in companies that have already won and not in the next big thing. So I will never invest in loss-making companies, for example. And I will also never invest in cyclical companies or companies active in cyclical industries. Think about, yeah, obviously commodity companies. So gold mining companies, companies like Cameco, gold mining companies, for example, companies active in lithium and so on, because obviously when these commodity prices go up or down very heavily, well, you can't manage that, or it's really hard for those companies to manage that. Also companies within the oil and gas industry, usually also excluding construction companies. So, for example, you have home builder companies like NVR, which are beautiful businesses, also cannibal stocks, so heavily buying back shares. But those are obviously the businesses that you want to buy when they decline by 40 or 50% because the outlook of the economy looks bad, investors start to panic, and that's when you want to look into those kind of companies. But I would say, yeah, cyclical companies and loss-making companies definitely won't fit the criteria. And also trying to avoid companies active in rapidly changing industries. So, yeah, everyone knows that AI, for example, is a big thing. But for me, who doesn't have a lot of expertise in the technology sector, it's really hard to make an educated guess about how the industry will look like in 10 years and which companies will be the big winners or the big winner within AI.
Pew, sound the alarms. We have a new sponsor alert. That's firmreturns.com. It's a stock research blog. Our friend runs that, and it covers companies from all around the globe, but it leans really more towards the UK, as that's his home market, and it gives him easier access to management, and he provides ongoing updates on the companies that he's invested in, as well as an archive of longer form write-ups that you can access all for free. There is a paid tier, but there is tons of free content out there. And these reports are very thorough. To give you an example of just how thorough some of these are, at one point he was digging into a company's account, and for one company he wrote up recently, he actually managed to find a material misstatement that had been missed by the auditors, and management reached out and confirmed the error to him.
And these are companies of all different sizes, from all different sectors and all different markets around the globe, but with a focus on his home market in the United Kingdom.
If you want to check this out, firmreturns.com. Like I said, tons of free content on the website. If you're interested in one of the paid plans, you can go to firmreturns.com/chitchat. That's firmreturns.com/chitchat, and it'll get you 20% off. How do you incorporate valuation into your analysis? I know when we're talking about the quality mm-hmm. of a business, valuation really doesn't seem to. It's maybe a byproduct of the quality, but it's not a part of the business's quality. But obviously, if you pay an insane multiple, it can be hard to generate the returns you want as an investor. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, so to execute a strategy in three steps, it's probably buy one of the companies led by excellent managers. And once you found them, you try to buy them at fair valuation multiples, right? So the longer your investment horizon, the more important the growth of the intrinsic value becomes, and the less important the valuation. And don't get me wrong, I absolutely don't want to say that valuation isn't important, because it definitely is. And look at what happened to Coca-Cola, for example, when it was trading at 50 times earnings in the 70s. Look at what happened with Walmart around 2005, if I recall correctly. If you overpay for a great business, well, you can end up with horrible investment results, even if the intrinsic value or the fundamentals keep growing attractively. So what we are trying to do here is indeed one of a company is the fair price, and really not trying to use complex formulas or trying to calculate the intrinsic value to two decimal spaces. So as Keen said, well, try to be approximately right instead of exactly wrong, right? So that's what we are trying to do here. And for me and readers of Compounding Quality will know that, I always use three models to value a company. So it's just one is very, very short-sighted, but do get a first quick grasp. Just compare the forward P with the historical average and the evolution of the forward P. Second model is an earnings growth model. And third one is a reverse DCF. I'm not sure whether you guys want to go into one of these models, but if you want me to, feel free to state so.
No, I think it might be tough to walk through the reverse DCF via audio, but I like that approach, kind of the three-pronged approach to valuation, especially, I know it sounds simple, but just looking at the historical averages of those forward earnings multiples, it's kind of simplistic, but that's something I always do, just as sort of like the surface level, what's this trading at relative to its past? I like that. I want to get into, unless Brett has any more questions around general framework, I want to get into some actual examples here. So let's talk, for starters, what's your biggest winner and biggest loser over your investing career? And then maybe we can break down what happened in each one.
Sure. So biggest loser is actually my first investment, and it's a funny one. So it was a loss of minus 60%, 60%. It was funny because I think I already told this story in the newsletter and other podcasts. But basically, I started investing at age 13. I had no clue what I was doing. But I was interested in stocks. So I set up my brokerage account, and then I put all my hard-earned money that summer to my brokerage account, but I had no clue what stocks were, how it worked, and so on. So what I basically just did at that point in time is I was a expert list, and a new topic was added to that list that week. And I just very short-sighted thought, okay, they know what they are doing. I'll put all my money in that company. And it was a Belgian company. I'm from Belgium. It was Exmar, which is a company active in the transportation of oil and gas. And remember, a few minutes ago, I told you that I will never invest in oil and gas, right? So evolved a bit since then. But yeah, put all my money in there, had no idea what the business was doing, knew nothing about oil and gas, knew nothing about the transportation sector, no diversification. So basically did everything wrong. But to me, that was probably the best thing that could have happened to me, because it was obviously really painful after 1 year and then sold with a loss of 60%. But it just resulted in the fact that I thought to myself, okay, well, I will never make this kind of mistakes again. I'm going to read, listen to the radio, newspapers, nowadays podcasts and so on. So it cost me a bit to become obsessed about investing. So I think that making plenty of mistakes in the beginning is definitely a good thing for you, because it's way better to make a mistake with $1,000 than with $10,000, right? Regarding the best investment, it depends a bit, because you might know that, Brad and Ryan, I started Compounding Quality in October last year, and I basically made the commitment that all my investable assets are invested in that portfolio. So right now we are still building up the portfolio, and I'm gradually switching my old portfolio to the Compounding Quality portfolio, right? So the Compounding Quality portfolio is 60% invested right now. When you look at this portfolio, but once again, started October last year, so not too old yet, and those results don't tell you too much, right? Best performance are probably MatBase right now, which only also recently published its results, which is up 60%. So they are basically helping biotechnology companies to do their clinical research. So August Schwindler founded in 1992. He's still the CEO and founder, obviously, but he's still the CEO. And almost all his net worth is invested in the business. It's a beautiful business, still growing at attractive rates and so on. Other one is probably Kelly Partners Group, KPG, and it's an Australian company. And it's basically, it reminds a lot of companies like Berkshire Hathaway, Markel, Constellation Software. So I'm putting up high expectations here, right? But it's basically a serial acquirer in accounting solutions. And Brad Kelly founded the company in 2006. He still owns almost 50% of the shares, 60% insider ownership. They doubled in size about every 3 years since their IPO. And Brad Kelly is a phenomenal guy. He always says, well, Warren Buffett and Bernard Arnault from LVMH are brilliant examples for me. So he really tries to live that model. And to give another thing, well, for example, Lawrence Cunningham was also in the board of directors of Constellation. He's also in the board of directors of KPG. Also, William Thorndike from the outside just invested in KPG. So it's a small cap and a potential to become a quote-unquote the outsider stock. So really interesting one. So those are probably the two best performing stocks within the compound quality portfolio. But remember, the portfolio only exists since October last year. So still very, very fresh. When you look at the old portfolio, which is gradually being transformed to the compounding quality portfolio as we gradually become fully invested, right? Some of the best performers are probably Copart, Microsoft, and so on. And yeah, I also just checked before the podcast. The funny thing is, I'm also invested, and it's a long time ago that I added to the position, but I also invested in the MSCI World as well as the S&P. And the funny thing is there, it has been a while since I added to my position there. They are both up more than 250%. So also there, over time, when you have a long-term approach, investing in the index probably works. And that's probably the biggest lesson for me, at least, is that when you have a loser, well, indeed, like the famous sayings, try to cut it as fast as possible and let your winners run. And when a company does really well, I would have no problem when it becomes 10% of your portfolio, for example.
How important is management in your process?
For me, it's really, really important. And it's one of the key lessons I took away from reading everything of Buffett. Warren Buffett always talks about the importance of management over and over and over again. And we know that 70 to 80% of all acquisitions destroy shareholder value, for example. Well, if you ask me, the key reason for that is that management has its personal agenda a lot of times. So they are acquiring another business for prestige, for their bonus, because it's tied to their revenue and so on. So what you want is that the incentives of management are aligned with the ones of you as a shareholder. And obviously that's hard to measure, right? The incentives of management. How can you increase your chances that they are aligned? Well, it's by investing in companies led by managers that are heavily invested in their own company. So you have a study of the Harvard Business Review that states that founder-led businesses are performed by 3.9% per year on average. And when you know that in the long term, almost no one is able to outperform or to perform in line with the market, when you know that almost no one is able to outperform the market in the long term, well, by just using a simple strategy like investing in founder-led businesses or family companies, well, you already do way better than the market. So it's very straightforward, I guess. And you have examples there like Kelly Partners Group and Matt Pace, we just talked about, two founder-led businesses. You have in Sweden, Evolution AB, with high insider ownership. You have an insurance company like Brown & Brown. You have, obviously, Constellation Software with Mark Leonard and so on. So those kind of companies, quality businesses led by people with skin in the game, that's, to me, the most important thing. And probably 70% of my portfolio is invested in those kind of businesses.
Okay, so we've gone through the winners and losers. Glad that first investment didn't discourage you, because it seems like you've had a good career since. So let's maybe talk about some other examples. What's a business that really hits all the criteria that you're looking for?
You meet all the criteria, so also valuation and so on. Everything ticks the box.
Let's strip out valuation for now.
One company that popped into my mind while you were talking, and it's basically, I should watch out that I'm not sharing too much right now, right? But it's a recent addition to the portfolio as well, and that's Dino Polska. I'm not sure you both already heard about the company.
Yeah, the grocer, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The Polish? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So Dino Polska is a Polish company, a Polish grocery company, and some listeners might now think, what the hell are you looking into Poland, right? But it's actually a beautiful business, and it reminds you a bit of in Costco. And the beautiful thing here is that Dino Polska is one of the only companies I know, one of the only quality companies I know that can still reinvest everything back in the business. Once again, it's a founder-led business. So all around 51% of the shares are still in the hands of the founder. And he's really an outsider manager, so to say, in the sense that he's famous for looking into the cheapest garbage bins to save a few dollars and so on. And they are heavily expanding from the west of Poland to the east of Poland. Now, what makes them unique? What is their competitive advantage? Well, two things probably. Well, they own 95% of their own stores, which is completely different compared to their main rivals. And this allows them to be cheaper than their main rivals and so on. And they also have an extreme form of standardization. So every store looks the same. They focus on rural areas, so where competition is not as high as in other areas of the business. And that really makes them unique. Another thing that makes them unique is right now, when you look at Dino Polska, you will see that the valuation is probably around 22 times earnings, right? Depending on when you listen to this episode. But what you see is, like I said, Dino is still expanding heavily. So when you look at their stores, you will see that around 40% of their stores are still less than 3 years old. But when you have a new store, well, basically the first year, the store is still loss-making. After 2 years, well, the free cash flow margin is about 3%. And then after 3 years, it reaches full profitability, around a free cash flow margin of around 8 to 10%. So this also means that all those new stores, 40% of all new stores, still need to reach their full profitability. And once that happens, well, obviously, the profitability of the business will spike. Earnings will go up, and that in the company and the economic reality, the company's earnings are way higher, and as a result, the valuation is way cheaper than how it looks like right now. So Dino is definitely a company I'm a happy shareholder of right now.
Yeah, there's a couple. I was looking in Poland. I was doing like a screener, and there are a lot of pretty high quality businesses, at least in terms of ROIC and some of those return metrics, that trade at pretty cheap multiples. Maybe it has to do with the geopolitical situation or just the macro environment over there. One of the other ones that I came across that I know you've looked at before is Text. Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, sure. Text is a tough one in the sense that it's really cheap. Probably around 13 to 14 times earnings right now. What is the reason? Well, the fun ones, and maybe the first thing to start with, it's a very healthy business. So it's also the insiders own around 50% of the business. The company has a free cash flow margin of around 50%. So for every $100 in revenue, they generate $50 in free cash flow, right? It has been a very strong compounder in the past. So yeah, it looks like a beautiful business. There's only one problem, and that's also why the stock did not so well over the past few months, is that two things actually. First thing is, well, there are a lot of people who are worried about AI. So maybe the most important thing, and I forgot to mention that indeed, well, what is Text? They basically deliver live chat solutions to companies. So when you go on a website and you see a live you are reaching out to the help desk, and the live chat solution pops up, well, that's often from live chat. So That's what they are doing, and the market is really worried about AI and says that how will it affect the market for live chat solutions? Will it completely disrupt those kind of businesses? Well, when this is the case, well, even a PE of 12 to 13 times earnings can be a lot, right? So that's the uncertainty in the market. Other part is that at the end of last year, the end of 2023, the company changed its revenue recognition policy, meaning that they generate it's a SaaS company. So they generate their revenue via subscriptions. And last year they said before, they basically, when someone took a yearly subscription, they just added that revenue entirely to that month right now, right? And right now they are doing it pro rata. So when someone, for example, took a yearly subscription October, well, 3/12 of that is for that year, and then the rest is for the year after. So that optically resulted in lower earnings and free cash flow and monthly recurring revenue. That's the most important metric for them. But obviously, economically, nothing changed. But it's a funny one that you touch upon, text, Ryan. Why? Because text is a company I've been looking at in the past. It's a company that's under review. And that's also, a lot of people are asking questions, well, when should you sell a quality stock? And well, the answer is, well, when your homework was correct. The right time to sell is probably never, because the company keeps growing its intrinsic value and attractive rates and so on. But when should you sell a company? Well, when you made your homework and your homework might be wrong. So I did my homework on Texas A. I thought they have a sustainable competitive advantage. But when we look at the reality right now, maybe the moat or the competitive advantage is weaker than I initially thought. And when this is the case, yeah, then it's probably opportune to cut your losses as fast as possible and let your winners run. So Texas A is definitely, it's a cheap one. It's a beautiful business, but it's definitely a tough one. And not the company, if you ask me, to make your largest position, for example.
Earlier in the show, you heard us talk about the investing platform, public.com. That's where you can trade options with no commissions or per contract fees, and you get a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract. NerdWallet recently gave Public 5 out of 5 stars for options trading. If you want to see why, go to public.com and start getting a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. This is paid for by Public Investing. Options are not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures are in the podcast description. US members only. FinChat.io is the complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. They have all the standard financial data on more than 100,000 stocks globally. And beyond that, they have company-specific segment and KPI data on more than 1,500 stocks. So to give some examples here, you want to see Netflix's average revenue per member over the last 10 years? They've got it. You like to track YouTube's advertising revenue? They've got that too. If you want to see Celsius's revenue that comes from Costco, how much of their revenue comes from Costco? They also have that. So the breadth of FinChat segment and KPI data truly is one of a kind. I use FinChat every day to track and manage all my investments. I also use it to discover new investments. And if you want to get 15% off any paid plan, go to finchat.io/chitchat. That's finchat.io/chitchat to get 15% off any paid plan. The link will also be in our show notes. Okay, one more question, and then I want to talk about your book. The portfolio sizing, position sizing, how do you think about it? Is this something that you just equal weight everything, or do you do starter positions? What's your process like for that?
So basically, I always use the same 15-step process to analyze a company, and I give a company a quality score on each of these 15 criteria. And then in the end, the total quality score. So the key rule here is, well, the higher the quality score, the higher the weight within your portfolio. And for the portfolio, we'll probably invest in a bit more than 15 stocks. So that's not too much. What's the key reason for that? Well, when you are being so strict, so you want quality, you want skin in the game, you want reinvestment opportunities, and so on, there are not many companies that remain. And the companies that remain, a lot of them are trading at very lofty valuation levels. So it's really hard to find those kind of businesses, which is why, well, the portfolio will be probably 15, 16, 17 stocks. And regarding that, well, once again, cut your losses and let your profits run. When you notice that you might have made a mistake, well, sell the business as soon as possible. And on the other hand, well, let your winners run. So, for example, the largest starting position or starting weight I took in a company was 5-6%. But when a company doubles in value and the weight goes to 10%, 11%, or 12%, well, I would have no problem with that. And I would definitely recommend people listening, well, I would say the more experienced you are, the longer you are investing, the less diversification you need probably. Because in the beginning, we will all recognize that, Brad, Ryan, in the beginning, you are making plenty of investment mistakes. Just if you say you don't, you're probably lying, right? But the more experienced you get, the better you do your homework, well, the less diversification you need probably. That's also what people like Warren Buffett and so on said. So letting your winners run and investing in great businesses is probably the key philosophy here.
Okay. You just published The Art of Quality Investing. First of all, what was the process like? I'm always a little curious about that. And then second of all, maybe the more important question, what value are you hoping readers get out of the book?
Yeah, first of all, credits to those who deserve. I think Luc Caruso did 99% of the work. He's one of my best friends. And we have been talking about quality investing for years and years, every day, basically. And the funny thing is that even while I say that Luc did the majority of the work, writing a book or working on a book is so much work. It takes so much time. So credits to all publishers and credits to all authors, because I really probably underestimated how much work it was. But it was a really lovely process to work on that with luck. And I would say, yeah, what would the goal of the book be, The Art of Quality Investing? Well, first thing, yeah, explain the entire quality investing philosophy to everyone. And the goal really is that when you are new to investing, by reading the book, you are able to get the basics of the philosophy and be able to get to work with it yourself. But also for more experienced investors, like talking about the difference between the traditional return on invested capital and the operational return on invested capital, things like that are also very important. So hopefully an experienced investor will also learn something from that. But yeah, I think that when with the book, we can change or improve some investors' lives and improve their investment process and investment thinking. I think that that's what we want to achieve. And it's Charlie Munger, who said, well, sometimes their answers worth billions of dollars in a $20 or $30 history book. Well, I have huge respect for everyone who has written a book, because indeed, you can read from everyone. You can read The Art of Quality Investing. You can read from Buffett, Peter Lynch, Joel Greenblatt, and so on. They have written all their wisdom. It only costs a couple of bucks, and you can learn so much from that. And I think that's something amazing. And when you keep reading all the time, well, you can't help but become very successful, I guess, in whatever field interests you and whatever field you are reading about.
Do you wish you could have given the book to 13-year-old Peter?
Absolutely, because I would be way richer when 13-year-old Peter would have read the book, for sure. So I think that's the case indeed. Investing is a process. You keep learning, you keep evolving. And yeah, that's the goal. And probably also when you have yourself or your 10-year younger self or 20-year younger self in mind when you write something like this, or write a book, that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Like we all know the saying, well, it's good to learn from your own mistakes, but it's even better to learn from other people's mistakes. Well, that's exactly the case here.
Okay. And for any listeners that are interested, where can they go find the book?
The book is available on Amazon. So when you search for The Art of Quality Investing, you will find it right away. And obviously, yeah, hopefully people will like the book. And in that case, well, the goal, we achieved our goal, and it would be an amazing thing.
All right. I think that's all the questions we have. I'm looking at Brett. Do you have any more here?
Let's close out with this. What's one takeaway for someone that doesn't know anything about quality investing, just heard about it in this episode? What's one takeaway you want them to have after listening?
I think that the important rule here is that quality outperforms, and there are multiple roads that lead to Rome. Value can do really well, low volatility investing, dividend investing, and so on. But when you just look at the data, when you compare the MSCI World Quality Index with the MSCI World Index, for example, well, you see that quality outperforms by more than 3% per year on average over the past 20 years. That's a beautiful thing. So just buying an equal weighted index, an equal weighted ETF based on this investment team did really well. And I would say that this will continue to be the case over the next 10 and 20 years. And when this is true, well, nobody can be against investing in the best companies in the world, right? So it's a beautiful investment strategy, very straightforward. And I love to be associated with it and spend all my day trying to find those kind of companies.
Awesome. All right. For anyone who wants to keep up with more of your work, what are the best places to do that?
Probably Twitter or X, we need to say nowadays, right? So compounding quality there, or also the website compoundingquality.net, publishing all my investment cases, the portfolio and so on there.
Awesome. Well, that is going to do it. That's going to wrap here. Thank you, Peter, for coming on the show. We want to remind listeners that Brett and I are not financial advisors. Anything we say on the show is not formal advice or recommendation. Any positions discussed in today's show, we may buy, sell, or hold at any time in the future. So just know these are not recommendations. Appreciate you all listening. And thank you again, Peter, for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It was a true honor, and have a lovely day.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.